B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Thursday, May 17th, 2018. A year to the day after the origination of the special counsel investigation and the appointment of Robert Mueller, the former FBI director, the end game is now very clear. This investigation is approaching a dead end, a cul-de-sac. And this has been clarified in comments in the last day or so from Rudy Giuliani. So consider the source. But this is not contested by the special counsel's office. And what we are learning from the big mouth Rudy 9/11 Giuliani is that Bob Mueller, reading the rules of his appointment, and he's not an independent counsel like the guy who spent 10 years investigating Bill Clinton, wasn't quite 10 years. That was Ken Starr. The bottom line here is that Bob Mueller has acknowledged that he will not seek indictment of Donald Trump at the conclusion of his investigation, no matter what surfaces, because he accepts the current Office of Legal Counsel position that a sitting president cannot be indicted. Now, this is a controversy that has been a cloud over Mueller's probe since the beginning, and it was not clear if he would contest the unresolved constitutional question of indicting a sitting president. And so now we have two options remaining. He can write a report and give it to Congress, praying that they might impeach the president, or he could name the president an unindicted co-conspirator as he pursues the prosecution of underlings. Now, I have been raising this issue for the past year, because it has not been clear to me that there was a viable endgame to this Mueller investigation. And this underscores my belief that Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic leadership have made a serious blunder, one of constitutional proportions, by saying, no, we're not going to talk about impeachment during these midterm elections. That'll bring out the Trump voters in a kind of Trump backlash. Well, Trump's going to create that backlash anyway, and he's going to bring out those voters. And this is just a real shell game. And it may, in the end, be seen as a cruel hoax that we have fed the cable news dogs their daily diet. And in turn, they spew it back on us with the Trump-Russia narrative and the presentation that this is such a dangerous peril for the American experiment. And how does the opposition party, the so-called resistance, respond? By patting us on the head and saying, oh, no, don't talk about impeachment. That could make things worse. And as you know, I believe the exact opposite. The Democrats have little to lose by unifying, nationalizing their congressional campaigns and saying, hey, here's the proposition. Give us control of the House and we will impeach Trump. The evidence of obstruction of justice is quite clear to me. The evidence of fraud, of all kinds of inappropriate financial dealings. There's plenty to impeach Trump on. What is lacking is the political will. And now that the idea of an indictment and a court trial for a sitting president has been eliminated, where will the Democrats go next? Where will they lead the followers of this failed brand, this Democratic Party? So the way this evolved is that Giuliani met with some of the Mueller people. He said that at that meeting, one of Mueller's deputies acknowledged that the president could not be indicted. 2 or 3 days later, Mueller's office called Jay Sekulow, another one of the president's lawyers. He's not an impeachment lawyer, actually. To say that prosecutors would adhere to the Justice Department view. So this makes very clear that despite all the headlines and the excitement, and I see my Facebook friends every day say, "Godspeed, Bob Mueller," they believe that this is going somewhere. And at some point, they will have what my high school teachers warned me about, the rude awakening, when it becomes clear that the Democrats are not interested in risking their political capital to rescue the nation from this clear and present danger that they rail about every day. And I don't know what kind of emails you get from the DNC and their ancillary organizations, but the focus lately is all about Citizens United. And that is such a long con. I certainly oppose Citizens United. I'd love to see the Democratic Party get serious about campaign finance reform. But the perverse nature of this, these emails say, "Citizens United, chip in $3. So, in order to fight the corporate influence on campaigns, they want us to give them money on an effort to change the Constitution that is 8 years out at best. And so this just creates this picture that the Democrats are so feckless and insincere about taking on Trump that they prefer to just let this drama play out to entertain the populace. And they will use fear, loathing, and, "Hey, we're not as bad as Trump," to appeal to Democratic voters in this midterm election cycle. Also, it should be noted as a backstop, Rod Rosenstein, the guy that Mueller reports to because Jeff Sessions says he recused himself, he also will not permit any pursuit of an indictment of this sitting president. So Trump, on the anniversary of the Mueller appointment, got on his Twitter machine and said, "Wow, word seemed to be coming out that the FBI, the Obama FBI, spied on the Trump campaign with an embedded informant." His source? Andrew McCarthy, a former prosecutor who appeared on Trump's favorite TV show, Foxy Friends. Now, there is a little bit more to this, but it's still not a conclusive assertion at this point. So the mouthpiece, Giuliani, is saying, "I think the investigation should be thrown out. He is shocked to hear that they put a spy in the campaign of a major party candidate, maybe two spies." He did not add anything to that, and Trump likewise has not added anything beyond the assertion that this has occurred. But in yesterday's lengthy opus about the code name of the investigation, Crossfire Hurricane, that was opened by James Comey and FBI top brass in the summer of 2016, there is a paragraph here that reads like this. "The FBI obtained phone records and other documents using national security letters, a secret type of subpoena, and at least one government informant met several times with Carter Page and George Papadopoulos," current and former officials said. So, once again, we have an anonymous source to a claim that there was at least one government informant who met several times with members of Trump's campaign. Now, these are the people who he says were schlubs that he barely met and they didn't have any real role in the campaign. But now he's deeply outraged that there is an allegation or this report based on an anonymous source that there was at least one government informant inserted into the Trump campaign. Now, I'd like to pause for a moment here and note that I heard howls from Rush Limbaugh this morning about national security letters. And I even heard Rachel Maddow on television last night kind of talking tentatively about these, national security letters. Well, if you are a regular listener of the PBC podcast, and allow me to toot my own horn here, I have been talking about the obscenity of national security letters since the Patriot Act was passed in 2001. It is the legal authority for the use of these widely abused, self-executed subpoenas, An FBI agent with the approval of a manager or supervisor can write a national security letter. Doesn't it require approval of a judge or a court? They issue it to a person. And, for example, the best case is they used to use them on librarians to find out what a subject's reading list looks like. And so they'd go to the public library, they'd present a national security letter, which came with a gag order. So the librarian could not notify me, "Hey, Collins, the FBI was here looking at the books that you've checked out recently." Now, the Inspector General of the FBI has reported annually for years about the widespread abuse by the FBI of national security letters. But when they're used on little people and Muslim Americans, suspects, and those who are caught up in these FBI sting and framing operations, nobody cares. Those kinds of civil liberty cases are just quaint. But when the Trump campaign gets caught up in webs created by national security letters and paid FBI informants who are inserted into a group of individuals, suddenly it's out of bounds. And unfortunately, their selective outrage will not last long enough for them to try to rein in the use of national security letters or the use of paid FBI informants during investigations. And I want to repeat for you, as I quoted yesterday, the critical paragraph that is buried on page 19 of a 21-page printout of the New York Times article yesterday about Crossfire Hurricane. Quote, "A year and a half later, no public evidence has surfaced connecting Trump's advisors to the hacking or linking Trump himself to the Russian government's disruptive efforts." You wouldn't know that if you read a dispatch from the Associated Press, which says, quote, "Russia favored Trump in 2016, says Senate panel." Now, I referred to this a little bit yesterday, but I want to drill down a little further. Because after I completed my podcast, we got reporting on a meeting that I mentioned between members of the Senate Intelligence Committee and the people who I think are responsible for the launch of the Trump-Russia narrative: James Clapper, the former Director of National Intelligence, John Brennan, the former CIA Director under Obama, and Mike Rogers, the former Director of the National Security Agency. So after they met with these guys, they issued a carefully crafted statement. And here's Richard Burr's quote. "His staff spent 14 months reviewing the sources, tradecraft, and analytic work conducted by the intelligence agencies. He said his committee uncovered no reason to dispute the conclusions of the intelligence estimate released in 2017. And I want to correct myself. He used the word intelligence assessment, not estimate. An assessment is critical. Because when you go back to that 2017, it was January 6, 2017. They published this, it totaled 25 pages. Some of them were blank. Five of them were a misguided attack on the RT television network. But when you read it, it offered no conclusions. A series of weasel words about we assess this and we assess that, and it's consistent with this, it's consistent with that. And so now, using the same carefully crafted language, they say, "We found nothing to dispute the conclusions of the weasel word document from 2017. They're not saying that they embrace those conclusions. They're saying in this passive double passive voice, and Hamish, I'm sorry if my grammar here violates some of the rules. Hamish is our house grammarian based in Australia. This is bullshit. And it's bullshit saying that our bullshit matches their bullshit because we didn't find anything that caused us to dispute the original bullshit that was asserted. And this is what passes for journalism. This is what passes for an investigation and the informal conclusion that they are asserting they have reached. It is just amazing. And so many Americans will never look critically at this. Hey, the headline said that the Senate Intelligence Committee agrees with the intelligence report. Case closed. But that's not really what happened. You may recall last year, the Trump administration joined with Saudi Arabia in punishing the Gulf nation of Qatar, claiming that they were funding terrorism, that their Al Jazeera network had to be shut down. And as we have reported, that occurred at about the same time that Crown Prince Jared Kushner's family was trying to secure a $500 million loan from a fund in Qatar. Well, after the Qataris said no to the fund, the loan request, that's when the repudiation and the efforts to isolate Qatar began by the Trump administration and its allies. That's more or less behind us now. Things have kind of normalized. And today, Daddy, Charles Kushner, the head of the Kushner Companies, announced that they have secured funding from a company called Brookfield, headquartered in Canada, and its major investor is the Qatar Investment Authority. This is to bail out their bad investment in 666 Fifth Avenue in Midtown Manhattan, which apparently was Jared's big blunder while Daddy was in jail. And it just shows the corruption of the people around Trump, including his own family members. Now, I can't conclude on, you know, exactly what came first, the loan or the improved relations with Qatar, but it smells just the same. Jeremy Scahill does a great job at The Intercept today, reporting on what appears to be a done deal, the confirmation of Gina Haspel as CIA director. And Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate leader, is working to grease the skids in a parliamentary fashion so that there is no further debate about Haspel's record as a torturer. And Scahill talks about the work of Dr. Sandra Crosby, a professor of public health at Boston University, who has evaluated one of the victims of Gina Haspel's torture program. He was at the site in Thailand. We believe that she presided directly over torture sessions involving Abdul Rahim al-Nashiri. And Dr. Crosby describes him as simply destroyed, one of the most severely traumatized individuals that she has ever seen in her 20 years of treating torture victims. So he was at the Cat's Eye Prison in Thailand from October. It was run by Haspel. From October to December of 2002, he is alleged to be involved in the bombing of the USS Cole in Yemen in 1999. Crosby stated that among the known acts of torture committed against Nashiri, he was suffocated with water, that's waterboarding, subjected to mock execution with a drill and gun while standing naked and hooded, subjected to anal rape through rectal feeding, threatened that his mother would be sexually assaulted, lifted off the ground by his arms while they were bound behind his back, dislocating his shoulder. So these are really gruesome and grisly tasks, and Gina Haspel's been allowed to write a letter saying that, gosh, looking back, it was bad and I'll never ever do it again. But her boss openly supports waterboarding and all forms of torture, and she followed orders before. And I think we have to expect she would follow orders again. Every day I pause to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Great people like Arlene Montemarano, Abby McMillan, Paul Tomaselli, Faith Peoples. And I invite you to join. Maybe pause the podcast right now, pop over to peterbcollins.com. There's a menu tab that will appear no matter what device or system you use. Click on it, then select Become a Subscriber. You land on the sign-up page, and you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our $50 annual subscription. I need your support to keep this work going. And if you don't like PayPal and you want to do it through the U.S. mail, You can communicate with me at P.O. Box 150-660, San Rafael, California, 94915. That's Box 150-660, San Rafael, 94915. So yesterday, Trump staged an event at the White House. He brought in a bunch of Republicans from California, from Fresno, from Orange County, the real red zones of the state. And he wound them up and got them to deplore sanctuary policies in the state of California and attack Governor Jerry Brown. And in his comments, Trump talked about the dumbest, we have the dumbest laws on immigration in the world. He hammered his administration to do much better in keeping out undesirable people, including members of MS-13. And, of course, he believes that MS-13 is comprised of people from other countries who want to enter our country illegally. But it's just more of his informed idiocy, his willful ignorance. As you know, MS-13 was born on the streets of Los Angeles and expanded into a transnational gang. And you cannot deport people who are U.S. citizens. Well, maybe he can. Anyway, he went on to say in this widely quoted hate-filled attack, we have people coming into our country or trying to come in. We're stopping a lot of them. You wouldn't believe how bad these people are. These aren't people. These are animals. And they're taking them. We're taking them out of the country at a level and at a rate that's never happened before. This isn't the first time Trump has referred to human beings as animals. And it won't be the last. But it is particularly offensive to hear it at this time after they've announced that they're going to intentionally split up families who arrive at the border as a form of punishment and a way of trying to deter future immigration. And let's be fair, as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton embraced a similar policy. She just didn't put it in really mean and candid terms. So Governor Moonbeam had a reply. I don't know if he tweeted this or just issued a statement. Trump is lying on immigration, lying about crime, and lying about the laws of California, flying in a dozen Republican politicians to flatter him and praise his reckless policies changes nothing. We, the citizens of the fifth largest economy in the world, are not impressed. Oh, and Trump also suggested fatuously that the mayor of Oakland should be investigated by Jeff Sessions, the attorney general who was in the room, for obstruction of justice because she warned people that there was going to be an ICE roundup in the Oakland community a few days before one actually happened. And Trump misquotes and misstates all of the information from that episode to try to turn that into a criminal act. And it just shows how low we have sunk. At the same time, we're seeing copycats, Republicans who figure that their path to power is to imitate Trump. And in Georgia, Republican candidate Michael Williams, who's running for governor, a position that would give him zero authority over immigration, the only thing it would change would be sanctuary policies in a handful of pockets of Georgia. So he has emerged with a campaign toy. It's a big old bus that he's had painted, deportation bus. And on the back, it quotes Trump, murderers, rapists, kidnappers, child molesters, and other criminals on board. Follow me to Mexico, the paint says on the side of the bus. And this is just another example of the way Trump has set a tone that allows others to go even lower than he sometimes does. And the political calculations involved here are surfacing because there is a move now by 20 members of the House. They only need 25 more Republicans to sign on to what's called a discharge petition. And together with the minority Democrats, they would force the Speaker of the House to give an up or down vote on an extension of the DREAM Act, the DACA regulations that protect the so-called dreamers here in the country. But the future leader of the Republicans in the House, Kevin McCarthy of Bakersfield. He's saying, hey, guys, don't push for that because we're going to be seen as soft on immigration. We'll lose control of the House in the fall because all those Trumpers will feel like we're not doing a hateful enough job. We're not being mean enough. His advice? Do nothing. He's also caught because the knuckle draggers in the Freedom Caucus are threatening to hold up an agriculture bill if they don't get a vote for a more conservative immigration bill, which would probably include massive amounts of money for Trump's border wall. So Kevin McCarthy is walled in by the immigration extremes in his own political party. Israel reported that there was some machine gun fire originating from Gaza that hit a building in the Israeli city of Sderot. No one was injured. The injuries to the building are unspecified. But Israel responded with a wave of airstrikes on Gaza City. They claim were aimed at a military compound and a weapons production facility. And today in the New York Times, Brett Stevens takes up the Israeli line. His headline reads, Gaza's miseries have Palestinian authors. And he uses a selective focus and selective history to blame the Palestinians for being rousted from their land and imprisoned in the open-air compound known as the Gaza Strip. He says, Palestinians in the Strip have set fire to the Kerem Shalom border crossing through which they get medicine, fuel, and other humanitarian essentials from Israel. Soon we'll surely hear a great deal about the misery of Gaza. Try not to forget that the authors of that misery are also the presumptive victims. There's a pattern here, says Stevens. Harm yourself, blame the other. And it deserves to be highlighted amid the torrent of morally blind, historically illiterate criticism to which Israelis are subjected to every time they defend themselves against violent Palestinian attack. And he recites history, not accurately, and says, which brings us to the grotesque spectacle along Gaza's border over the past several weeks, in which thousands of Palestinians have tried to breach the fence and force their way into Israel, often at the cost of their lives. Now, that's a gross overstatement. There have been handfuls of the mostly peaceful protesters who have rushed the fence. And the idea that this presents imminent danger to the security of the state of Israel is just absurd. And he quotes selectively a Palestinian, Ahmed Abu Artima. We are intent on continuing our struggle until Israel recognizes our right to return to our homes and land from which we were expelled. And he interprets that to be a statement advocating the elimination of the state of Israel, when it is a call for a recognition of their rights, their right to return to our homes. That does not preclude Israelis living alongside the Palestinians, but that's how it is extremely interpreted by the New York Times' Brett Stevens. One more quote. Why is nothing expected of Palestinians and everything forgiven, while everything is expected of Israelis and nothing forgiven? And I've linked to the Brett Stevens piece and what I'm about to cite for you from Dr. David Glick. He is a psychologist here in the San Francisco Bay Area. I've met him a few times. We recently were at a gathering, and he later shared a commentary that he wrote 4 years ago that I am linking to in today's show file for this podcast. And David Glick is an American Jew who supports the rights and aspirations of the Palestinian people. He is a rare independent thinker. And his commentary goes into his own exploration of the history of Zionism, which I find quite accurate. He talks about manifest destiny. The U.S. long ago accomplished its goal of manifest destiny by committing genocide against the native peoples who bravely but in vain opposed the theft and conquest of their land. Unlike the U.S., Israel arrived late on the scene, Consequently, it is still in the process of implementing its own version of Manifest Destiny by relentlessly seeking to acquire virtually the entirety of Palestine from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River at the expense of the Palestinians living there. And here's where his work as a psychologist is extremely valuable. He writes, inevitably, Israel's overwhelming military might and its brutal occupation and oppression of the Palestinian people understandably produces among Palestinians that same helplessness that leads to despair, rage, and resistance. As a result of a mutually reinforcing cycle of violence and aggression, fueled by fear and rage on both sides, is then let loose with tragic consequences for all. Psychologists call this mutual projective identification, a concept that operates unconsciously and elucidates one of the core dynamics of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. If one sees oneself exclusively as a victim of the other's violence, it is all too easy to believe in one's essential innocence and goodness and the righteousness of one's cause and actions. We then become blind to our own hostility, violence, and aggression, and attempt to rid ourselves of these disowned parts of who we are by projecting them onto the other. We then see in the other what we refuse to see in ourselves and act toward the other with that disowned aggression that inevitably evokes the defensive and retaliatory behavior of the other that is then used to confirm our picture of them as essentially hostile, violent, threatening, and evil. I hope you'll read Dr. Glick's commentary. I found it really thought-provoking and very powerful. Yesterday in the U.S. Senate, supporters of net neutrality won a symbolic victory, and we can credit Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, a man I knew as a member of the House, for championing at least this effort to highlight what the Trump administration is doing to destroy neutrality on the Internet. The bill passed by 52 to 47 or 48, and unfortunately, it would have to also pass the House of Representatives, where it's dead on arrival, and get a signature from the comb-over in the White House. So that's not an expected outcome, but hey, activists, I'm not giving up. Over in the House, the Democrats have just about every member on board. They have 162 of the 192 Democrats, and they need to get to 218. That's not impossible, but it is not probable at this point. And finally today, we've talked at some length over the past year about the deep need for reform in the Democratic Party. And based on an article in today's New York Times, it appears that the establishment Democrats are giving ground and that by August we will see a major change in the rules that provided the superdelegates the ability to ram Hillary Clinton as the Democratic nominee in 2016, despite her obvious flaws and her lack of a positive upward trajectory toward victory at the time of the convention. So based on this, there is a discussion to either eliminate superdelegates altogether or reduce them down to about 280. These would be elected officials, not party leaders, according to the language that's being discussed. And if that happens, that would be a dramatic improvement. I would like to see total elimination of the superdelegates. But there's also discussion about changing the rules in the primary to schedule debates way earlier. And Tom Perez, who I don't support as chair of the DNC, has said that in order to rebuild trust, he will ensure that no candidate participating in the presidential nominating process gains any fair, unfair advantage, real or perceived, during the primary season. Now, we'll see what actually shakes out in the end, but it does appear that the message has been received. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. We serve it up on YouTube. Tell your friends to find it there. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.